It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Tunisians peacefully elect a president for the first time since independence. Deadly explosions in Nigeria take at least 26 lives. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Veteran politician Baji Kaid Essebsi was declared winner of Tunisia's Sunday presidential runoff, the first free election since independence from France in 1956. The election authority Monday announced the 88-year-old former minister who heads the secular Nida Tunis party will replace incumbent Mansif Marzouki after winning 56% of the vote. Outside party headquarters in Tunis, several hundred jubilant supporters took to the streets, celebrating, waving the country's national flag, singing and honking horns. In Washington, U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf congratulated Tunisia on its peaceful democratic transition.
Tunisia's achievements this year laid the groundwork for a more stable, prosperous, and democratic future for the country. We look forward to working with the president-elect and Tunisia's new parliament and government to strengthen and expand our country's enduring friendship and strategic partnership.
The ouster of longtime President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali in 2011 inspired the Arab Spring uprisings across North Africa and the Middle East. Two explosions in northeast Nigerian states Monday killed at least 26, wounded dozens of others. A car bomb at a bus station in Gombe City killed at least 20, burned some beyond recognition. Hours later, in neighboring Bauchi State, a massive explosion rocked a marketplace, setting the entire area ablaze. The cause of the blast is also unclear. No immediate claim of responsibility for either explosion, but the attacks and locations are hallmarks of previous strikes by the militant Islamist group Boko Haram. In a separate attack Sunday night, suspected Boko Haram militants drove into the northeast town of Gaydon in Yobe State, spraying gunfire, destroying cell phone towers. This is VOA News. The World Health Organization Monday said the death toll from the Ebola outbreak has risen to more than 7,500. The number of cases as of December 20 last Saturday exceeded 19,300. On his return from West Africa Monday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon told reporters in New York he witnessed immense suffering and had a message.
Ebola caregivers should be praised, not shunned. People who have traveled to Ebola-affected countries and have no signs of infection are no threat. I also repeat my call to avoid travel restrictions, border closures, and other counterproductive obstacles. As we fight the Ebola virus, it is equally crucial to combat the contagion of fear.
Canadian company Techmira Pharmaceuticals announced Monday it will supply one of its experimental Ebola treatments for clinical trials in West Africa next year, targeting the Ebola Guinea variant of the virus. The UN mission to Central African Republic says it's concerned about weekend confrontations that included armed clashes with UN peacekeepers. Meanwhile, a Roman Catholic cleric stood up against knife-wielding anti-Balaka militants as he attempted to help a sick Muslim girl and her parents at a roadblock north of Bangui. Nick Long reports.
A doctor with the team, Elkana Ndawacha, tells VOA what happened next.
C'était horrible.
He says it was horrible. The anti-Balaka had a grenade and they threatened to throw it at our cars if the group tried to leave. They also had knives, he says, and they dragged a pearl out of one of the cars and were going to kill him. And Ndawacha says Archbishop Nzapalanga intervened and grabbed the arm of the man who was about to draw a knife. The man pulled out the knife and the Archbishop was left holding the sheath. The doctor tells the OA that the eight people with the Archbishop had to argue and fight with the 10 anti-Balaka for 10 minutes before they could get away. A local journalist who also witnessed the incident, Yovis Uwakara, confirmed the account. The sick girl made it to the Archbishop's house and was transferred to a hospital. Ndawacha says the incident happened next to a roadblock manned by Central African police or gendarmes. He says they were about 15 metres from a gendarmerie roadblock, but none of the gendarmes intervened to help. Many observers have questioned the neutrality of the Central African security forces in the CAR's sectarian conflict. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
Clashes Monday between pro-government and Islamist forces in Libya's eastern city Benghazi killed at least 11, wounded dozens of others. The fighting has also spread to a third oil port, curbing gas exports and cutting crude production to less than the domestic needs of Libyans. Ethiopia's prime minister warned Monday South Sudanese leaders face punitive sanctions if peace talks fail to end their year-long conflict. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ebola death toll rises to a new high as the UN Secretary General calls for more international preparedness.
I intend to engage member states in a serious effort to explore what more we can do to stay ahead of the next outbreak of disease or test that is sure to come.
U.S. officials warned against complacency in the fight against Ebola. A political veteran elected Tunisia's new president. Zimbabwe's president continues the purge of his cabinet ministers, allegedly affiliated with sacked Vice President Joyce Mujuru. And the African Union looks back on the peace and security challenges of 2014.
Probably two challenges. One has been, of course, mainly South Sudan and Central African Republic, which were countries that were facing conflict and a lot of problems.
Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma is chairperson of the African Union Commission, and Ugandan doctors come to the aid of Sudan's civil war victims. Those stories plus Marco Uman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The World Health Organization says the death toll from the Ebola outbreak has risen to more than 7,500 people and that the number of cases is nearing 20,000. The latest data posted Friday reflects recent trends, with Liberia and Guinea seeing a decrease in the rate of Ebola transmissions while Sierra Leone's cases continue to rise. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who recently returned from visiting the three hardest-hit West African countries, said the international community needs to better prepare for the next global outbreak of disease.
Over the past few days, I witnessed immense suffering. Ebola is a terrible disease that denies the humanity of its victims and stigmatizes its survivors. But I also saw almost superhuman acts of kindness and support. My presence in the office today is meant to send an important message. Where people saw no symptoms, others should show no fear. Ebola caregivers should be praised, not shunned. People who have traveled to Ebola-affected countries and have no signs of infection are no threat. I also repeat my call to avoid travel restrictions, border closures, and other counterproductive obstacles. As we fight the Ebola virus, it is equally crucial to combat the contagion of fear. We must learn the lessons of Ebola, which go well beyond strengthening public health systems. The international community needs better early warning and rapid response. I intend to engage member states in a serious effort to explore what more we can do to stay ahead of the next outbreak of disease or test that is sure to come. Today, our immediate goal is simple: zero cases. Even one case can trigger an epidemic.
That was UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. U.S. officials are worried that progress in the global effort to curtail the spread of the deadly Ebola virus could lead to overconfidence and a reemergence of an outbreak that has already claimed more than 7,000 lives. As VOA's Jeff Seldon reports from Washington, both health officials and lawmakers are warning that the fight against Ebola may be entering its most critical phase.
On the outskirts of Freetown in Sierra Leone, children laugh and play, smiles on their faces. Survivors of an epidemic that claimed the lives of their parents. In neighboring Liberia, some markets are bustling again ahead of the Christmas holiday. U.S. Senator Chris Coons, speaking on a phone conference from Monrovia, says it's impossible not to take notice.
More than anything, I've been impressed with how social mobilization by Liberians at the very local level is what has made the essential changes that have changed the trajectory of this disease.
In Liberia, hand-washing stations are everywhere. Person-to-person contact is limited. These measures are working, Kuhn says, but he worries they'll be difficult to keep up.
It's very uncomfortable to be at a church and to not shake anyone's hand, to not give anyone a hug. It is unusual to have your hands washed in chlorine every time you walk into a building and have your temperature checked every time you walk into a building.
The U.S. Embassy in Monrovia says Washington has spent $770 million fighting the Ebola outbreak in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Nearly 3,000 U.S. military personnel have been sent to the region to build treatment centers and help with logistics. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also has hundreds of people on the ground. CDC Director Dr. Thomas Frieden, just back from a trip to the region, says while the progress is undeniable, there should be no sense of security.
The fact that we've seen an exponential decrease in many areas doesn't mean we're going to get to zero without redoubling our efforts.
Efforts to strengthen health systems across the region are underway, and the U.S. expects new detection methods to be available in the coming months, and possibly even an Ebola vaccine. Still, Dr. Ron Waldman at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University warns the problems go beyond West Africa.
This outbreak is now a year old, more than a year old, and a large part of the reason that it grew to one of this magnitude, which as we're seeing is extremely difficult to control, is that the international community did not respond aggressively enough, rapidly enough, efficiently enough to the warnings that it was given.
Officials and doctors still sounding a warning. As long as there's still one case of Ebola out there, a new wave of infections can't be ruled out. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
2014 was supposed to be the year of a green revolution for Africa, with agriculture and food security in the forefront. But a number of factors came into play and scuttled the revolution. In this exclusive interview with VOA, African Union Chairperson Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma says although some gains had been made in realizing an agriculture-led growth, the Ebola crisis in West Africa and conflicts in South Sudan and the Central African Republic were some of the great challenges that the continent faced in 2014?
Well, I think probably two challenges. One has been, of course, mainly South Sudan and Central African Republic, which were countries that were facing conflict and a lot of problems. But we are coming towards the end of the year. The AU was able to stabilize Central African Republic through its men and women who were on the ground there, and we eventually handed over to the United Nations on the 15th of September. And with South Sudan, we're trying to get that country to keep to the ceasefire, but also to look forward into how they're going to deal with their issues together and take the country forward. But on the other areas, the most challenging has been the Ebola outbreak in the three countries. It's been challenging because of the way it has turned out, the magnitude, the length of time it has taken, and the fact that it was in fragile states and it was in countries that had never seen Ebola before. But more importantly, it's an epidemic that needs people to change their traditional practices, things that are very entrenched and very central to their social cohesion. And also, it's an epidemic that needs people to change how they relate.
That was Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, chairperson of the African Union Commission. She spoke in an exclusive interview with Sandra Nyaira of VOA's Zimbabwe service. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 23rd. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a special shout out to our affiliate station, Buffalo FM in Monrovia, Liberia, Brela FM in Nigeria, Kisi FM in Tanzania, Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi, and Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Veteran politician and staunch anti-Islamist Beji Kai Essebsi has been elected Tunisia's next president. From Paris, Lisa Bryan reports for VOA.
Official results give 88-year-old Beji Kaya-Desebsi nearly 56% of the vote in Sunday's runoff election, compared to 44% for incumbent interim president Moncef Marzouki. Secularist Desebsi was expected to win the vote and declared early victory as polls closed on Sunday.
Aujourd'hui, c'est le commencement de l'avenir.
In remarks broadcast by French TV, Mr. Essebsi said his election marked the start of Tunisia's future. He said he wants the nation to move forward united. He also saluted those who voted for his opponent. The vote closes Tunisia's somewhat rocky transition to democracy, nearly 3 years after a January revolution ousted longtime dictator Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. The vote triggered the saw Mr. Essebsi's secular Nida Tunis party emerge with the most votes. It beat the moderate Islamist El Nahda that has been in power for much of this post-revolution transition. In voting for Mr. Essebsi, analyst Anthony Dworkin of the European Council on Foreign Relations says Tunisians cast a vote for stability.
I think they went for a figure after 3 years of chaos and turmoil in the country and little economic progress. Some security problems. I think the attraction of Essebsi and his party was really that he was someone who could get the ship of state back on course, that he was a tried and tested, a competent hand, and someone who would be able to move things forward.
Mr. Essebsi served under both former President Ben Ali and Tunisia's first post-independent president, Habib Bourguiba. As president, he's responsible for security, defense, and foreign affairs, but his party will also command parliament, although it must first seek political alliances to do so. Looking ahead, analyst Dworkin believes Tunisia needs major reforms of key institutions to consolidate its revolution.
It's not clear that the people around Essebsi and Essebsi himself had that kind of vision. Certainly what we've heard is much more to do with consolidating the state, which perhaps is necessary, but it needs to be consolidated and reformed. And that's the challenge.
Tunisia also has to heal its divisions. The presidential campaign was marked by mudslinging on both sides, and the vote was split both ideologically, pro versus anti-Islamists, and geographically. The northern coastal areas tended to vote for Mr. Essebsi, while the south went for Mr. Marzouki. The future of El Nahda, the country's second biggest political party, will also be key in moving forward. It's unlikely Nida Tunis will pick El Nahda as a coalition partner. What's essential, analyst Dworkin says, is that the Islamist party retains a legitimate role in the opposition. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe continues to purge his administration of ministers suspected to be aligned to his dismissed Vice President Joyce Mujuru. In addition to 7 ministers sacked last week, Mr. Mugabe over the weekend sacked 2 more ministers and 5 deputies believed to be Mrs. Mujuru's allies. The former vice president is accused of trying to overthrow Mr. Mugabe, a charge she denies. Former Deputy Justice Minister Fortune Chassi confirms he has been sacked, but said he will not leave the ruling ZANU-PF party.
From the point of view that one is appointed, I don't think one should be surprised when they are relieved of duties. I think from the vantage point of the head of state, I think when he is satisfied that there is a need to reassign people or remove them from the positions, I think that is a perfectly normal procedure in any organization.
Do you view yourself as a Mujuru loyalist, as being peddled in some reports?
No, not at all. I am just a member of the party, and I do not subscribe to any particular individual. My loyalty is to the organization that liberated this country. So any suggestion that I belong to any particular grouping of people or that I belong to a particular individual is completely erroneous.
Fortune Chassi is Zimbabwe's sacked deputy justice minister. He spoke with Blessing Zulu of Views Zimbabwe Service. Political analyst Charles Magonjira says First Lady Grace Mugabe is behind the purge of her husband's cabinet.
It didn't come as a surprise to many of us who have been carefully watching what's been happening. I think that if you look at some of those ministers and deputy ministers that were fired, you know, some of them were very unpopular with the First Lady. I can give you the example of, you know, Fortune Chassi. He was singled out, you know, in one of the First Lady speeches, and she basically said she didn't like him. So, you know, we knew that this was coming. In fact, this is not the end. I think that as they are on their holiday and reflecting in the Far East, I suspect that there will be a bigger cabinet reshuffle, and I personally would put my money on the First Lady being appointed to one of the portfolio ministries, particularly the gender, women and community development portfolio.
But according to the letters of dismissal, there's a citation of not being able to discharge their duties as dictated by the state. What do you make of that?
No, I think this is just an excuse that the president and those in his office are giving. The truth of the matter is that this is part of the political purge. And most of those, you know, people, if you look at their performance in their ministries, it's not different from any of those that have been left. In fact, some of those that are still in government today, you know, have been performing worse than those that have been fired. So it's got nothing to do with performance.
That was political analyst Charles Magonjira speaking with Chris Gandhi of Views Zimbabwe Service. In the Sudanese state of South Kordofan, the number of amputees as a result of civil war is in the thousands, but few have access to sufficient medical help. Adam Bills recently visited the area. He says a small team of Ugandan doctors has been providing remote help, producing new prosthetic limbs for those in need.
In Sudan's Nuba Mountains, civilians are trapped in the middle of a conflict. Government forces have staged thousands of aerial attacks since 2011. Mother of Mercy Hospital is the only fully functional medical facility in the Nuba Mountains. Wards are overcrowded. Beds line corridors, transforming them into makeshift wards. 9-year-old Rob Mohammed was injured in an aerial attack and lost his right leg. But today, he is able to walk again. Just this morning, he was given a new prosthetic leg, part of a program run by a team of Ugandan doctors. Rave has already made drastic improvements, walking without the aid of a crutch for the first time in almost a year. Prosthetic technician Simon Peter says Rave's parents were away when the bomb fell on his house.
So when the bomb, these people released the bomb, they got him inside the house. And it cut off the right leg.
Peter says most victims in the Nuba Mountains are middle-aged men.
35 to 40. Oh, yeah. And these are active people. I think they meet problems as they go to look for food for their families. Sometimes, you know, as a man, and most of them are men, they try to defend their families. As in a process of defending a family, they meet sometimes maybe gunshots or landmines or whatever.
When Rabe was injured, it took his parents hours to reach the hospital. Many people have to travel as far as 200 kilometres to receive treatment. This can take days and mean the difference between life and death. The project works to get help to those in the most remote areas. With no facilities to produce prosthetic limbs inside the region, doctors take a cast and limbs are produced outside the country. These are some of the limbs they have brought to fit patients who were measured last year. An estimated 50,000 people are disabled as a result of the conflict in Sudan. South Kordofan's Deputy Governor, Suleiman Jaban, says most of them were hurt in bombings.
Daily basis, If they're not bombing here, they're bombing in other areas. And we get the report, the Lamy Mazalan is continuously bombing now. All these days in bombing, killing civilian, injured civilian, and burning their houses and burning their crops.
In South Kordofan, hundreds of children like Rabe are under constant threat from attacks, hiding in caves with their families. Many children have spent their whole lives living in war. For now, Rabe is going back to his village, far from the hospital, one of many to face a difficult future. Adam Bales for VOA News, Gidel, Sudan.
It's coming up at 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Coach Androni Goikoetxea remains in charge of the Equatorial Guinea football team as they prepare for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. The Equatorial Guinea Football Federation President Dominic Ejang told the media in Malabo on Monday. He dispelled speculations that either Nigerian Stephen Keshi or former Ghanaian coach Milovan Rajevac will take charge of the team for the Nations Cup as Goikoetxea's contract expires at the end of this month. Ejang clarified that it is too late to contract a new coach and that the current coach will continue to serve until the end of the Nations Cup to be staged in Equatorial Guinea from the 17th of January. The Equatorial Guinea team is currently in a training camp in Lisbon, Portugal, preparing for the Nations Cup. In women's football, African champions Nigeria Super Falcons are the most improved African women's team, while South Africa's Banyana Banyana have slipped by the widest margin, according to the latest FIFA rankings released in Zurich, Switzerland. Nigeria ranked 32nd, Ghana are 50th, Cameroon 52nd, Equatorial Guinea 54th, South Africa 60th, Ivory Coast 65th, Algeria is 77th and are immediately followed by Morocco, then Tunisia, while Egypt are 87th. Turning to athletics, Alex Kibet and Abraham Kapsis Kipyatich secured a 1-2 Kenyan triumph in the men's race at the IAAF cross-country permit meet in Brussels, Belgium on Sunday, while 19-year-old newfound Sheila Chepngetich Keter triumphed over the British Commonwealth Games 1500-meter champion Faith Kipyegon in a Kenyan 1-2 victory in the women's race. Finally, in Spain, Ugandan Timothy Toroitich emerged winner in the men's race at the Venta de Banos International Cross Country event on Sunday. Ethiopian Mimi Belete was victorious in the women's race. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Oma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, December 23rd.
I think the lesson to learn from the earthquake decision by U.S. President Barack Hussein Obama to open diplomatic relations with Cuba is that Americans and friends should not only step out of mundane ways of the past and stop chasing shadows, but to chart a new path that may reap dividends from a new neo-welfarist Washington in Havana neighborhood. I am your loyal listener, Ambrose Ajio from Makurdi in Benue State of Nigeria.
Well, thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The World Health Organization says the death toll from the Ebola outbreak has risen to more than 7,500 people, and the number of cases is nearly 20,000. Tunisia has elected veteran politician Béji Kahi Essebsi in its first free presidential election since independence from France in 1956. And a bomb at a bus station in Nigeria has killed at least 20 people and wounded another 21. That's it for this Tuesday, December 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing everybody in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Sunday Shomari. Join me every Monday for your lighthearted show, Let's Talk. That's right, Monday at 17:30 UTC for interviews, great music, and a whole lot of laughter. Right here at the VOA Africa. Keep it locked. VOA Africa. Don't miss.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for VOA's discussion program, Reporters Roundtable, every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas and take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA.